Hey everybody, welcome back to 10% True. Just before you get stuck into this episode, I wanted to let you know that in 2024, I'm going to be republishing my book, Red Eagles, America's Secret MiGs. That's the story of the 4477th Test and Evaluation Squadron and the program Constant Peg that exposed American fighter air crew to secretly acquired and operated MiGs in the Nevada desert in the 1970s and 1980s. The book's been out of print for a while. It goes for crazy prices online, but I'll be republishing as a softback exclusively through my website, 10percenttrue.com. If you're thinking about supporting the channel, you'd like to buy the book for yourself or even as a gift, please do go and place a pre-order. I'll put a link in the description. All pre-orders are going to be 25% off, and I'll make sure I personally inscribe and sign your copy for you. Anyway, I'll let you get back on with enjoying this episode. Take care. JP, welcome back to 10% True. Thanks for joining us on the channel again.
Yeah, good to see you again.
So for anybody who's tuning in on this, this is clearly part two. There is a part one with JP where he talked about how he got into the Royal Air Force and ended up flying Tornadoes. This was just ahead of the first Gulf War in 1991. And if you haven't watched that, go back and watch that now because it will make this second part make sense. But JP, when we left off last time, you had talked about how you were going to go and hit this airfield target in Iraq. There had been some debate about the tactic that was going to be used. You'd argued at your case, but had ultimately lost. And you had therefore resigned yourself for the fact you were going to go out and fly the mission. And we got to the point where I'd said to you, did you have any trepidation? And you said that there was, you were just walking to get something to eat. And you just, so there was this sharp intake of breath. When you paused and then you got on with it. And that's really the point that we got to. So can you pick up where you left off?
Yes, certainly. So yes, you suddenly realize it's real. That sounds a bit weird. You know, it's real anyway, but it's just sort of, okay, we are going. Breakfast, came back, finished the planning. And then pretty much you're in a funnel that you've done 10,000 times. You know, you finish the plan, you then walk off to, you've got all your maps, you've had the briefing. So you have an intense brief before you go flying of what could, should, what ifs, and all that sort of stuff, standard procedures. You go off to the changing room and you get into your kit. Well, you're in flying kit, but you put all your flying kit on. But you also sort of, when I say you sterilize yourself, what that means, you take off anything that, things like rings, anything that distinguishes you at all. So all your flying badges come off, they're on Velcro, so you take those off so that you literally are name, rank, number, date of birth. Effectively, just they won't even say whether you're a pilot or navigator because all those badges are off. So you change, you put your G suit on, your life jacket. You've got your gun holster, which is a gun in a shoulder holster, and you basically make sure you've got everything right. You go out to the authorization desk. You're authed for the mission, and then you walk out to the airplane. And at that time, you're very much thinking, trying to get everything sequenced in your head, which is a pretty standard process, really, for any sort of flying mission. But in this particular case, I think the thing that stood out for me as you were walking out to the jet is, when you've got live weapons on, there are a whole load of flags, which basically we have bolts that stop the explosive ejection units to push the bombs off. So everything that hangs off the jet, everything that hangs, pylon pins, basically, everything hangs off the pylon, you have pins on. And each of those pins have flags to make sure you pull them out. And you're very much, I remember thinking, I need 33 flags. I need to make sure I've got 33 pins. You work out how many pins per pylon that you need to take. And then pretty much you go through your sequence. You know, you've got the sort of green and red lights of the cockpit. You walk around, do your checks, and pretty much start up. And we were very nervous about making sure that the aircraft worked. You didn't want to be left behind. Now, one of the other guys in our formation, unfortunately, their jet wasn't serviceable, so they went off to another jet to get airborne, and I don't think that one got, well, that didn't get serviceable either. So that, I can imagine how they felt, because that would be really irritating on your first operational mission. So we went off as a three ship. So that was our, yeah, you take off, you climb to height to join the tanker. You refuel on the way, and then you get to that point where you have to drop off the tanker to actually drop down to low level, because we're doing a high, low, high sort. So to get the range, you go high level, then drop down below the radar horizon, where, because when you're at height, obviously everyone can see you, want to drop down so you get below the radar, which is the whole point of low level, so you avoid engagement by missiles as well. So you drop off and you start pushing down to going down as a formation to low level. At that stage, you've taken off all your switches. So you've switched your guns and bombs and everything. Everything is live, basically. So that so now that you're going into enemy territory, that you can fire the gun, you could drop a bomb if you wanted. You've taken off absolutely everything that will distinguish you and highlight you. And you're going on into targets. So you go from basically, you know, the tanker, which is about 15, 16,000 feet down to low level. So you go from a bird's eye view of the world down to 50 feet above the ground. So you go from the anodyne sort of serenity of height into suddenly you feel the sand and the rock as you're bumming along the ground, flying your bum along the ground at 50 feet.
Were you in a trail formation then? What formation were you in?
No, we're in battle formation. The way it works, just to battle formation is back in the day, you fly beam each other because we have a blind spot in our 6 o'clock. So you fly beam each other by a couple of miles, which means we can see 5-6 miles behind each other. So should any fighter come and drop in, blindside you, we can come across and engage them with missiles. So that's how we went on the mission. So you count down. There was, we've done that lots of times before, low level, because we've been out there, flown over the sand, etc. But then you get to the split point. You come off this where the formation we were going to attack from two sides. So we went off our way. The other two went off the other way. And yes, just then, from pretty much as you started getting close to the airfield, you start getting shot at. So suddenly you're getting anti-aircraft guns. So they're like ribbons in the sky. These kind of, you see the tracer coming towards you. You get plumes of missiles. You get anti-aircraft flaks, so great big puffs of black smoke on the left and right as you're going in. And then your whole tempo is moving up, with John doing the radar, me cross-checking. I'm flying lower as well, so we've picked up speed to about 600 knots. So, and you're pushing down in height, so probably 15 feet, 20 feet, whatever it is. I can't tell you. Basically really low. You're flying your bum along the ground. So if you've seen the Top Gun movie number two, that whole profile, and you see them flying over the desert, that was our height and speed that we were going in. And we were going to do a loft attack. And a loft attack is where, to attack an airfield, obviously you've got this almost like dome of defenses where you get medium, short range guns for missiles. So you don't really want to fly within this defensive dome that they have around the airfield. It's a ringed airfield. So what you do is a loft. If this is the dome, we fly up and then we pull up a number of miles away from target and we throw the bombs into the airfield. So it means you're in that space for a very short period of time. So you almost enter it, and aloft you pull up, the bombs go off, and the speed and the G of the aircraft throw the bombs a number of miles. And then we recover, and it's basically called a loft maneuver, where you turn upside down, pull, rotate. So it's azimuth, height, and turn. So it's very difficult for a missile system to lock up because everything's changing, height, direction, and you're only there temporarily, and we run out the other way very quickly. So as we got close to the target, yeah, everything's happening then. I mean, I'm literally flying through crisscrosses of bullets. You've got puffs of black smoke everywhere, plumes of missile, everyone's shooting at you, wham, wham, wham. And the clock is running down in the head-up display. You've got this green circle which winds down to zero. And at that point, the weapons computer takes over. So it gets down to zero. I pull up and I commit, which means it's not like an old aircraft where you push the red button, the bombs come off, which is called pickle. You commit where you hold the button and the computer works out when to throw the bomb in the right manner. So I'm going up, by which time everyone's shooting us because we're more visible. But my whole head-up display, all the green lines and everything just dump on me. And I'm going, shit, 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 where's it going? And everything's just gone. And it dumps on me. And I'm going up and up. And you're going up really fast. I mean, this is seconds, less than seconds. You know, you're 1,000 feet before you know it. And by the time of that height, you go, shit. So I roll upside down and I commence my recovery. And the bombs hadn't come off. So, you know, I've now got a tricky thing, which I didn't really think about at the time. I just completed a loft maneuver. But loft maneuver, I mean, it killed a couple of guys in the Gulf. So it's quite a dangerous maneuver. Well, I've never done a loft recovery with 8 tons of bombs on, you know. And it's really aggressive, certainly in the way we did in the war. We're doing 4G to really get it down fast, to get down below to escape the defences. So, yeah, I recovered the loft manoeuvre with 8,000-pound bombs on to get back down to, you know, 20, 30 feet or what have you to escape. And I am, the whole time, if you heard the black tip, I'm just swearing at John. I thought he'd made a mistake. That is our chagrin, that we're labelled that did he make the wrong switch error? In our book, we said we might as well just say he did, because it's the easiest thing. There are a number of other things that could have occurred with it. I don't believe John did push the wrong button. He never had pushed the wrong button. So, and there are a number of technical things which are not worth going through series. There's a number of technical things as to why they didn't come off. And I have a letter at home, which someone wrote to me saying had this could be the case, and I believe that one. And it's all about maths of ballistics and how computers work out and the height we were going in at. So there's a whole load of stuff there. But you know, we're then bugging out. We're going, okay, do we re-attack? Because you know, you're gutted. You know, you live this elitist life and you've got to go back to all your mates who've done their job and say we cocked up. How do you do that? But do we re-attack? But it's June clear day, they know you're coming, they've seen you coming, you're going to die, they're going to just make a better job. Everybody's going to be shooting because the other guys come from the other direction. The whole point is they don't know which direction you come. Whereas if we, as a sole aircraft, went in, the whole airfield will be looking at us. So, and there's another mission, you know, you've only got a 5-minute window, and there's another mission coming in three, four minutes later to do their job. So it's quite a tight bracket that you do your mission on, and that's how you overwhelm shock and awe with mission on the airfield to overwhelm their defenses. So we then made a decision. I pushed the red button and the bombs go dud in the desert, and that for me is the failure of our war. But then you've got to get home, so we're going home, and on the way home we went over what was looked like a small unit of men, but there were quite a few of them. And one guy, and this is the point, you know, you've got a £25 million aircraft there, with a handheld miss, 50 grand probably for a handheld, probably SAM 16, they reckon, which is a handheld tube, looks like a bazooka. Shot the missile. We didn't see it. It was right in our 6 o'clock, and it was a lucky shot, you know, shoot down jet with a pea shooter, really. The missile went right up our right-hand engine. The first thing I knew, you know, we're at 50 feet doing about 550 knots or what have you. The whole aircraft just goes kabang. It's like being hit by an express train. The whole aircraft rotates and it's almost like a sycamore seed. I'm seeing sand in the sky, and I'm trying to control the aircraft. I go to John, prepare to jet. I can't hold it. He said, don't you bloody well eject. The whole, you know, the whole pace of your life has suddenly accelerated to a really. I grab the wings to put them forward to get me more control. The aircraft comes under control. You get wow, wow, wow. I look down, my right-hand engine's on fire. We've got a panel here with about 50 lights which tell us what's wrong with the aircraft. Well, it's like a bloody Christmas tree. The flyable wire has gone out, being blown out as well. So I've gone from a Grand Prix race car as if I've, you know, you've got all the finesse of the computers. Well, that's all gone. And basically, flyable wire is I've only got one control system, which is the aileron, and that's connected by metal rods. And it really is. You move the stick, and about a second later, the aircraft actually moves. I mean, it's really kind of. So I'm actually quite pleased I recovered the aircraft, given I was in mech mode. Then on the right-hand side, an anti-aircraft battery opens up. The bullets, they hit my right-hand wing, and they hit my sidewinder missile, which is about 4 feet on my right-hand wing away from me. It ignites the rocket pellet, and a four-meter torture flame shoots out the front of the wing and slowly but surely starts to cut my right-hand wing off. So we've got some major problems here. We try and put the fire out because we can do 400 knots on the other engine. Couldn't put the fire out. I've got the flyable wire. I've got the missile on fire. I look back. John starts screaming, "We're on fire! We're on fire!" This is about 2-3 minutes later, and I said, "I know I'm on fire because I'm flying this aircraft like this, pretty much straight." And he said, "No, look back." I look back, and there's just a wall of orange flame. It was like flying the nose of an aircraft outside this comet of flame. And we were doing 400 knots or so, and this wall of flame was coming towards us. I couldn't see the fin. The fin's 13 feet high. I couldn't see it. There was this huge disc of orange flame. I looked out on my right-hand wing. I couldn't see my right-hand wing. It was just orange with fuel pouring out the back. Even the fuel pouring out the back was on fire. So I had this great big bulb of orange flame right next to me, bright orange, this disc coming towards my right. Basically, we are surrounded by orange, and you're going, shit, this aircraft is not going to survive. And so we made a number of checks, ready to eject. I eased the aircraft up, and 3, 2, 1, eject, eject, eject. So if you imagine me easing up and how fast we're going, we ejected at 320 feet. So, we were not very high, because this aircraft was going no further. So, you eject, it's like, almost like having a giant grab you by your shoulders and yank you out the cockpit. You get all the rocket noises. My eyes are closed. You feel the jolt, bang. You're on the end of your parachute. I look down. You're not very high. You unclip the box in the back. You sit on a box. You need to release that because you can land if the box is when you hit the ground and the box is still attached around your waist. It hangs around the back of your legs. You can land. It will just basically break your legs. So I release the box down. It hangs down on a piece of rope. You prepare yourself to land, parachute. All I remember, it just bloody hurt. It's like, you know, jumping off a 12-foot wall, but you're meant to roll and do all the parachute shit. No, I didn't. I just kind of landed like a sack of potatoes. And that's it. You're on the ground.
I wanted to, obviously, we've got a finite amount of time to go through what happens next. So I don't want to spend too much time discussing sort of the escape and evasion bit such as it was. I'd like to really understand the interrogation side of things and the captivity side of things. That's where I'd like to try and drive this conversation. But just quickly on that then, did you get injured during the ejection process? Did you or John get injured during the ejection process?
John didn't. My knee, I hurt my knee a bit. When I say a bit, it was only a little bit. But the personal equipment connector, which is where our oxygen tubes and radios that connects us to the seat, had obviously flown up and hit the visor. So I and I'd got a cut above my eye. And not a big cut, but a cut above my eye. So that was really it. Other than that, you know, what I subsequently found out later is, and this was after the war, that I had wedging, so two crushed vertebrae. My fifth and sixth thoracic vertebrae had been smashed together and it broke. Basically, I got a broken back. It had broken 15% on each of the, my vertebrae had been fractured.
So capture came fairly quickly.
Yes, we were in the desert for about 2 to 3 hours. You know, we made our plan. I mean, it was a bit ridiculous in the desert, you know, when we landed, because you've got all sorts of, you know, parachutes in bright orange. We couldn't get our walkie-talkie out without bright orange opening up our life jacket. So the ground's completely flat, visibility 50K. You know, you got a burning tornado. I mean, you might as well have had whistles and bangs and flags saying this is where we are. But we started our evasion. We made a plan. And about 2 hours later, a van arrived, a sort of pickup truck, and about 20 soldiers got out, spread out, coming towards us with the Kalashnikov machine guns. Then you got a decision. John said, you know, shall we go out with a bang, as in shall we stand up, take a couple of shots of them? Because we knew what was going to happen if we got captured from all the expectations of Saddam's regime. That was the time I said, no, there's always hope. And pretty much we were buried in the sand by machine gun fire. I'd taken out my contact lens because I wore contact lenses and it was just there. We were lying on the sand. There was nowhere to hide. And the very first bullet blew the contact lens away from here. It was only about 2 inches from my head. And then there were probably hundreds, thousands of bullets all bouncing around our head. I mean, literally, it was that many bullets we were buried in, being buried in the sand by the amount of bullets hitting the sand. Eventually they stopped. It was a bit of a dick dance to try and say who, you know, we were trying to give up, but they were scared of us, which is funny because we've only got two PPKs. Got to us, beat us up a bit, blindfolded us, took us off to the local airfield. At the local airfield, we'd just been attacking the air crew there. They interrogated us, but when I say that, they were quite, you know, they were quite respectful, actually. They said, look, you've got to talk to us. We said nothing. Talk to us or else we'll have to send you to the nasty people in Baghdad. That's what they did. So 10 hours to get to Baghdad. As we were approaching Baghdad, and it was dark, and you could see Baghdad actually being bombed, like you see on the TVs, all the light, you know, the anti-aircraft guns. That's when things started getting nasty, started smashing a face against the side of the lorry, hitting around the head with pistol butts. You enter in the city, everyone's manically firing Kalashnikov in the sky. You've got the bombs going off. Got the anti-aircraft guns. Those are very frightening because they're extremely loud. They're on tops of buildings, really loud, and they kind of consume you. The van stops. You know, we're blindfolded and handcuffed. They push you out. It feels like you go through this corridor of troops who are kicking, rifle butting, and thumping you. They push you into an ops building. Within 2 seconds of getting into the ops, suddenly you hear this huge, a bomb hits the building we're in. So all the walls are blown up. The ceiling comes down. We're picked up and almost like the hand of God and thrown about 2 to 3 meters and end up under a pile of desk, rubble, and chairs. They, when the dust settles, they pull us out. They put me in a room on my own. I'm trying, handcuffed and blindfolded, still trying to pull my head thing off, and then the door opens. I don't know, a number of men come in. My world goes black.
What had you been told then? You said to John, there's always hope. What had you been told by your intel people that would happen to you if you were captured?
It's not so specific as that. It's more, you know, interrogation will involve violence. You know, and you know Saddam's reputation, and you know it is. It's you anticipate, or you don't need to be a rocket scientist to guess. You know, your air crew, you're bombing their country. They are known to be a violent state. I don't think they'd signed the Geneva Convention, so you're not expecting a nice conversation.
What is going through your mind then when this is happening, as you're being with increasing intensity beaten as you go through this journey from the desert to this ops building? Are you taught, one of the things I'm really curious to understand is the psychology. Are you taught at survival school when you know, Siri is the American version, I don't know what the Brits call it, but are you taught techniques, methods of dealing emotionally and psychologically with the things that are about to happen to you? Is there anything that you can do to protect mentally yourself from what is going on, or are you resigned to the fact that this is going to be a pretty ugly ordeal?
It's going to be a pretty ugly ordeal, but the military does what the military does. A certain type of character joins the military, I'm assuming. And then over the millennia of us fighting wars, during officer training, all that sort of thing, let's send you up another hill with a concrete blocks for no apparent reason to make you walk 25 miles or what have you. And it's all about that you can go beyond your physical limits. Then you've got the tenacity and endurance of going through flying training, which is mentally tough. But within all that, most military training is crisis, immersive training in crisis management. How do you, when the world goes to batshit, do you objectively make good decisions under pressure? That is effectively military training. So that is, there's part of that, in fact, that we've done survival training as well. So you do survival training. I had done some interrogation training, which is basically just telling you almost effectively about the psychological tools that they use to break your will. So it's things like hard cop, soft cop, you know, Starsky and Hutch type thing, repetition questions, all those, sleep deprivation, you know, sensory deprivation. It's called dislocation of expectations. So if someone's been shot down, you've got the anxiety of that, and they want to sustain, and it's only short-lived, that anxiety of the shot down bit. And they want to keep that level of anxiety, that level of uncertainty where you're completely unsure, you don't know what's happening. And so that gives you a psychological pressure. So all that added together, you know, no water, no sleep, violence, separation, all this sort of thing creates a level of uncertainty in the human psyche. However, balance that off with the type of character, military training. And throughout that whole time, effectively, now, is it me? Is it military training? Probably mostly military training. In that sequence, shot down, you're literally on the ground. Okay. Once we laughed on the ground, you know, go, because we giggle, that's, you know, what the hell are we going to do? You then say, right. And you almost go, flying package out. Right. We're now in evasion. And you kind of almost slot that in. Right. Let's do this. What's our priorities? What do we need to do? Bang, bang, bang. Then, you know, the troops arrive. You almost slot that one. Okay. They're going to do it. So you actually, you go through a sequence where you're pretty objective and realistic. And I think that's military training. You know, yeah, it's high stress. Okay, how do we deal with this? What's the main decision we have to make? Make the decision, live with the result. Oh, shit, that didn't work. What's our situation now? What do we need to do? So you actually are pretty sequential. You know, that's why I find it interesting that people panic so much when I see, even in my business consultancy, people go, and you go, stop. Okay. It's fretful. What is actually happening here? What's the decision you need to make? Oh, it's now all gone. Something else. Did we try that? And you were fine. Stop. What's happening? So you get very used to almost dealing with the adrenaline rush and everything. So that's where you sequence in. You suddenly go, right, we're shot down. I'm now invasion. Guns, and now this, right in the car, right, I'm now going to enter a different thing. What do I anticipate? What do I do? How am I going to deal with it? Right, I'm now being blown up. Okay, I'm fine. I'm not hurt. Right, bang. The beating up, okay, I was unconscious. And then you're taken to, they took me out after the beating, and you're suddenly standing in a room, and the room's pretty standard size room, 10 by 12 feet, something like that. You can feel the hot lights on you. You're standing there blindfolded, handcuffed, bag in your head, and you can smell and sense there's about 7-8 men in there. You can smell sweat. You can smell smoke. They're all smoking. You have a sense of, you can smell violence and you can smell death in there, basically. And you go, shit, well, this is now, well, this is now probably what's going to happen. You don't think this is where I'm going to die. You now think, right, okay, I need to be here now. How do I use my brain? Start the interrogation sort of mindset. So at each stage, it's really quite, not exactly planned, but it is. It's feeding in your next cassette.
When I read the accounts of Vietnam War veterans who are POWs in Hanoi Hilton, they talk a little bit about the inevitability of giving up information and the fact that you have to make the interrogator work for it. So you know they're going to break you. This is what I'm reading. You know they're going to break you, and they're going to get bits of information out of you, and some information is going to age. So if you're asked a question on day 1 of your capture and you give the information, it might be useful to the enemy. But if you give that information on day 30, it could have been what the tasking order was or what was going to happen in the next 24 hours. That kind of thing. So it feels like there's almost a kind of schema behind the concept of being broken and giving information. And I wondered whether or not you had that too, whether or not in your mind you had decided that, you know, it was inevitable that you would give some information or you would give some answers. The Geneva Convention is, name, is it name ranks? Or name,
well, back number? In the day, it was the big four, name, rank, number, date of birth.
Yeah. So you would go beyond that. It was inevitable. Did you see it the same way? Had you created a framework in your mind or?
No, and I pretty much bought into the fact that I don't give out any information. However naive, and it's pretty naive, really. Thinking back, but no, I just kind of thought I will not give out information. I know this sounds silly and it makes me sound a complete knob, this, but it's just not cricket. And that makes, how stupid does that make me? Childish and pathetic does that make me sound? But you just don't give out information. And that, I balance that off with, you want to conform to all almost the war movies. You want to be an officer, you don't want to let other be, you're totally isolated, but you have a sense of responsibility to all your, the Air Force, your friends on squadron and everything. So I've got that, and the fact that you're a naturally competitive person as well. You know, everything up to that time in my life pretty much worked, so why would I expect not to work now? Balanced off that is actually having now done that process, this whole thing of name, rank, number, date of birth and don't release information, really it is to, you could say, delay the inevitable. It gives you something to hang your hat on. So rather than just kind of talk uncontrollably, let's say, because your anxiety, by giving that framework, it settles the mind. So as the first, baseball bat hits, you kind of go, shit, and your brains are scrambled. And at least name, rank, number, it gives you a framework to handle until actually you get used to the beatings, which you do. So it does give a useful framework. But on reflection, since the war, you go, in the modern world, what do you give them? We have a pointy end and a hot end. We go forward, we can't go back. We drop bombs, and obviously we're blowing up targets. But they're asking all sorts of questions where you go, irrelevant. What frequency do you fly with? Frequency agile. You feed in codes and then we only have 5 hours of frequencies at frequency agile jump. What does this do? I haven't got a clue. Switch it on. It does its bit. What about this? Don't know. What about, XYZ? We have codes. We're only issued codes. They're irrelevant now because it was 5 hours ago. Basically, you really give them nothing, because you can't. So, I do buy into the need to know principle, and the need to know, if you don't know anything, you can't tell them anything, and that saves violence. So that's what I used to come back when I said to a fellow aircrew, when you get back, this need to know, live by it, because what you don't know, you're you don't, they can tell when you're, you know, saying, I don't know. And they know in, you know, they've got all the psychologists looking at you probably at the same time. And they know that you don't know. So it is, yeah. So you don't really know very much, to be honest.
Can you go back and describe a bit more about what something you said just a couple of minutes ago? You said you get used to the beatings, and that was about 30 seconds after saying when they first hit you with a baseball bat. And I've never been hit with a baseball bat. I can't even imagine what that's like. But how does that work then? How does getting used to beatings work? Do you mean the psychology of it in terms of it's coming and therefore you accept it, or do you mean it somehow doesn't hurt as much?
Both. What happens is the first one, base brat red, so, you know, name, rank, number, are you pilot or navigator? I said, I was going to say, I cannot answer that question, sir, which is what you say back in the day for any other question other than name, rank, number, date of birth. I went to, I cannot, and then suddenly you literally, your head explodes. I mean, it literally, you are taken off your feet and you're on the ground. And then for the first 40 minutes or so, you've got 5-6 men with baseball bats just smacking your body, and you're on the ground like a rag doll. Your whole head is lolling around. You can't even form the F word in your head. You're just totally, as your whole body is just, you're trying to curl up, but they're just smacking you with baseball bats. They pull you back up again by your hair every time. The name, rank, are you pilot and navigator? I cannot, and you go back down on the floor, and they, during the time, and the first 3-4 days were most intense. So you don't, no sleep for 4 to 5 days, no food, no water for the first 3 days, and that's really bad. So you're really in a bad shape, and throughout that time consistently you are beaten with baseball bats, rubber truncheons. They set your hair on fire. They burn you with cigarettes. They threaten you with gang rape. They threaten you with shoving guns and knives up your ass. You have mock executions with guns against head, you know, triggers pulled. You know, you hear other people being tortured. You know, they burn you with cigarettes. Just all the stuff you see in the movies, really. So it becomes a very intense sort of fight with trying to battle of will. When I said it, you get used to it. You learn how the interrogation works. You learn the inflection in their voice. You listen to the voices, what they're trying to achieve. Your body does become numb to the beatings after a while. You know, they all hurt, but you almost go, well, that was a shit beating compared to the last one. You know, that wasn't quite as effective. And so the beating, it's almost like domestic violence. When people understand how does a female stay in an abusive relationship, the violence normalizes it. That just becomes your life. And you live moment to moment between each of the violence and trying to assess how you're doing, how they're doing. So it becomes a battle of will. So it is a mental fight, actually. It's not a physical fight.
Was there any one thing that they could do to you that you were particularly frightened by?
Well, you make your own list. They're going to break your arms, cut your balls off, pull your teeth out, set dogs on you, kneecap you, rape you, put a knife up your ass or a gun up your ass. You know, what do you want? Do you want to, you know, are they going to put your head in shit-filled water? You know, make your list. You know, which one of those is preferable? How would you grade them? How would you prioritize them? You know, this is what I find funny when you get back, you go, people go, you know, how often were you hit? I don't fucking know. You know, how often was John hit? I don't know. He was in another room. People want to pigeonhole where we brave, who was braver, John or me? Who was, you know, how did you deal with this? What, you know, what is worse? You go, I don't know. I don't know your face. I've told this story for decades, and I've met people 2-3 years after I've told my story, and I'm really disciplined. The fish does not become this big. I very much, that's what happened to me, and it's historic, an account. and I keep it as it is. But people go, oh, when they waterboard you. I wasn't waterboarded. People impose their own fear. So what would scare you? What would scare you?
Well,
out of all that list.
The reason I asked that question was because I wonder whether or not you're playing the long game, in inverted commas, which is that you want to get out of there at the end and go back and see your family or your wife or whatever it is. You want to go home at some point. And whether or not in your mind you're grading the things they can do to you in terms of the long-term damage that it does to you. So if they beat you up, they beat you up. If they start shoving things up your ass, you're going to get infections, right? So then, So you're going to end up with something that could potentially kill you and mean that you don't get out of there. So that's kind of why I was wondering. I was wondering if there was in your mind a of all these horrific things, there was sort of a scale where actually you'd rather get more beatings than have this, because actually the long-term effects might be better.
You don't think that. I basically, on the 10-hour drive on the way, and I made a mantra to myself, because I knew that I was going to do it, and I thought, right. And this is about this idea of almost this cassette things, I'm in the car being driven to Baghdad. And I thought, right. So you go, I'm no longer a fight bat, I'm no longer evading. I'm now on the way to this next event. I know what's going to happen to me. They're going to be violent. And the mantra I said for 10 hours and set my mind, because I'd seen the prisoner of war movies, and Midnight Express, all those sorts of old movies. And how the prisoner of war came back damaged. You get all the Vietnam movies where, somehow they're damaged, they're post-traumatic stress or this. And I made a promise myself, I will not come out a damaged human being. I am either going to die here or I'm going to disappear in the Middle East for 10 years, whatever the wars happen. I'm going to disappear into the Middle East for 10 years. And my phrase was, you can break my arms, cut my balls off, pull my teeth out. If I'm still around in 10 years' time, I will not be a damaged human being. And when I release in 10 years' time, if I'm not dead, Helen will have remarried. My children will call someone else daddy. I will not damage their lives either. Life has taken a different course. I will want to see them, but I'll let them carry on the course A, because our lives have now split. So that was my concept, I suppose, of love. And so I set my mind. Rape, so I, if I had been raped, I'd be telling you now, so I had a penis up my ass, right? I'm not gay. I don't have a problem. If you are gay, it's not my choice. I've never had a penis up my ass. If I had, I'd be saying, was not choice. Rape is rape, whether you're male or female. It's a crime of power, not sex. So you go, what choice? If they need, I'm a little bloke. If you need four guys to hold me down to rape, which they did, they had six guys holding me down when I thought I was going to get gang raped. What choice do I have in that matter? And if that bothers you as a man and questions your masculinity, you will lose, because it's not the physical violence, it's the mental. They're trying to get in your head. So don't be foolish. Whatever they do, you accept what they do. You just deal with the result. So that's, I set my mind for death or pain, basically. And actually, did I find something in captivity? I'm quite surprised. I know I'm military, but I'm not that military. I kind of find myself, but I actually I don't know what I found, but I found a comfort with myself. I found a sense of commitment to that. I'm quite proud of.
When we talked before the first interview, just before we were heading, before we hit record, we somehow got into a conversation about death or life or whatever it was, and you'd said you're not frightened of death. And I wanted to ask you then, is that lack of fear of death connected to your experience in Iraq then? Did you have the same feeling about death before captivity?
I've never thought about death before. Who thinks about death, for God's sake? I suppose I'll do this very quickly because it's very, it's all rather deep. But I found myself in captivity, doing one of the things, doing this, praying to God because I was really frightened. I thought, what am I doing? Because I'd say I was agnostic. But I was brought up when I went to Boy Scout, school. When I was brought up, schools did, you got all the Christian bit, the Bible bit, you got all the Sunday school bit, you got the Cubs and Scouts, all that sort of stuff, all quite Christian related. I was from about 12, I was really into it. Then it left me by about 14, 15. So I'd call myself agnostic. And I went, what am I doing? Am I doing this because of Pavlov's dog? As in, I had all this almost conditioning that we get told God exists, or do we create a psychological construct, as in human beings get really scared over the millennia of humankind, we need to create a bigger being. It's actually a psychological construct to cope with the uncertainties of life. Or am I praying to a deity? And at the time I believed in a deity. It left me the moment I left captivity, and I suppose I'm agnostic again, probably more nearer, closer to atheist. But I found myself going, I don't think, from my experience now, every single religion, this thing we called life, is meant to be, okay, I'm mixing my metaphors here, but almost purgatory. You know, oh my God, life is really bad, and we're put on earth as for 70 years by a benevolent God who tests us. And if we don't believe in him because we can't see him, we go to hell. But if we do, this horrible time we have on earth, 70 years, we go to nirvana, we go to heaven, everlasting happiness, everlasting love, all pain removed and beauty for infinity. So we're only given 70 years for all our fears, but for infinity, only if we believe in something we can't see. And that's every single religion. Christianity, if you're really good. Islam, if you're really good, you go to a perfect world. Buddhism, you get reincarnated to the highest of the chain. And even if you're atheist, there's nothing. So every single belief system in the world, when death arrives, there is no pain, there is beauty and better. So if you are a true believer, you should want to die because there is imperfection and everything our hearts desires. I don't have a problem with nothingness. So at the end of my, I think therefore I am. And you can tell I spent weeks in captivity. No one talks like this, for God's sake. But but you go, I think we're frightened of three things: pain, humiliation, and loss. None of us want pain, and that's what frightens of us death. Humiliation, it's like everyone at the moment, we used to be scared of cancer, but now, gosh, we can't scare people with cancer anymore because there's a great recovery rate. Oh, let's scare everyone with dementia. Okay, well, you don't want to be the person in your nappies going la la la, do you? So that's humiliation. You don't want to humiliate yourself, your dignity. And loss is very much, if I die, I won't see my children grow up, or I won't see my grandchildren, or I lose the people I love. So that's all about dealing with nothingness and the fact that our worlds revolve around ourselves. So none of us want pain, humiliation, or loss. So sounds very deep. You can tell that no one spends their life thinking like that. But those are the things I did. And death, you could ultimately remove pain, humiliation, or loss, because death itself removes all that. And if you are either into nothingness or into everlasting happiness, effectively. So it's the process of dying. So I was scared about the process of dying, but death itself, why be scared of death? Very deep, meaningful blah.
I think it's very interesting. Honestly, I'm glad you're sharing it with us. So I think this is probably a different side to an interview with a fast jet pilot who's been through the experience of captivity than perhaps you would normally get. So but so allied with that then, and without wanting to sound like a dick, I wanted to ask you then, did you, having said that your goal was to return, however long away, however distant it was from the point of ejection, to your you know, original life, even if it meant that actually your wife had remarried and your children were calling someone else dad, but that your goal was to go back undamaged. Were you successful? And was there the idea that you could control that? Was that an illusion?
No, it's an absolute. Not defined by circumstance. That's the whole point. You lock yourself into yourself. And you do not get defined by the circumstance. You are who you are. And it's my true belief that is ultimately human spirit. That is, I think we're only truly honest with ourselves. So I had a situation where they, halfway through, they took me into the living room. I was naked, two guys, small room, put a gun against my head again. And I remember the hammer, you know, starting to move. I could hear, and you got a quarter of a second or what have you before it drops. And in that moment, you have a million thoughts. And the thought was, I don't want to be, I'm basically going to die now, and no one is going to be, see me die. They're not going to see whether I'm courageous, whether I piss or shit myself. The simple fact is I'm now going to die. And I'm 1,000 miles from anybody, and there is no one left to impress. No one's going to see this. No one. I'm just going to be a body on the ground. And so you end up, I found myself going, I don't want to die disappointing myself. And in our lives, we're all on display. So when, probably the least on display is when you're naked next to your partner, having just made love. And all the silly things we say to each other. You know, you don't want anybody seeing that because we all talk rubbish. You know, that lovely, intimate moment after of closeness. But you're probably the most revealing to your most intimate partner. But you don't say everything that's in your head because none of us would have a relationship if what pops in our head. You just wouldn't have a relationship, you know, because you can't. Whereas suddenly there's no one to impress, no one to do anything, and you're going to die. So you turn inward. And for me, it's I wanted to die nice. That's the word I... I was brought up in a family that my people said my family that I was brought up is nice. People say that of Helen and me. And when I did English, our English mistress said, you know, never use the adjective nice, find a better adjective. But we all know what nice, when everyone says nice family, they're part of their community. They're respectful, they're pleasant, they're helpful, wrapped up in this word nice. So that becomes definitive. And I think we're only truly honest with ourselves a quarter of a second before we think we're going to die. Because there is no one, we all die alone. And that is all actually a defining moment where you go, no, this is who I am. And that, yes, you've got to go through maybe pain, loss, some humiliation. But you die with, it is almost the Buddhist view of, you know, life is suffering. It's how you deal with suffering that defines you. And you deal with both success and failure in the same manner. It, just because you failed doesn't make you a failure. Just because you were successful in one thing doesn't make you a success. They're just events. And it's how you deal with those things as a human being that defines the quality of the human being.
We just sticking with your sort of the personal side of things before we get back to the military side of things then. So I know I wouldn't ask you to speak on behalf of your wife, but what do you think your wife, or what has your wife said about the pre-war John and the post-war John? Is there a difference? Is there an improvement in quality of, you know, husbandship, friendship, as a person? And sort of allied to that then, you mentioned PTSD, and that's a label that has been appropriated by people in the most inappropriate of ways in recent years, but there are people who genuinely have that, and it is a diagnosis, and I'm not going to trivialize it. But looking at some of the videos I've seen of you doing presentations, you sort of go to businesses and you lecture them. You built an MBA course for Aston University here in the UK, I think. So that's part of your business life at the moment, but and this is turning into a very rambling, complex question, but I think you probably sense where I'm going with it.
How many questions are in this question? But carry on.
You do a lot of. I'll summarize the question. But you talk about the experience, and I wonder whether or not that process of repeatedly talking about it is cathartic, whether or not it helps with any PTSD you might have actually had. So the summary is, did your wife see a difference? Have you had PTSD? And does talking about it help?
Right, I'm going to unpack that in a bit. First of all, just talking about it help. How do I know? Because I didn't, post Second World War, no one talked about their war, and everyone goes they were stoic. I don't think they were stoic. It's more that if we were post Second World War, I'd go, "Hi, Steve. What do you do in the war?" And you replied, "Well, I lost my whole family." How do we get away from that? So it became impolite, I think, unless you knew someone, to say, "What do you do in the war?" Well, I lost my brothers, my mum, my dad, my children. So people didn't talk about war because everyone had experienced war. And why bring up pain and hurt to people? So people didn't talk about the war. Move forward to our generation and no one had been to war. And there was no filter. The level of curiosity and interest, certainly because of the media as well, because it was first live televised war, was just overwhelming. There was no filter. Everyone's desperately wanting to know what happened, and everyone wants to know about the poo, the torture, and all that sort of stuff. So I had a million questions pretty much straight out, and you answer them the best you can. Now, because that's all I experienced, I don't know whether the questions helped me or not. It just became part of the fabric of my life. So all these questions, it just normalized. Now, there is a thing that if you take trauma, definition of trauma, you have an extreme experience which has a heightened emotional experience. We assign a meaning quite soon to the events, the human psyche. And that's and invariably we assign the wrong meaning of, and the event. So that's why they say it's really important after a traumatic event, loss of a child, loss of a loved one, severe injury or what have you, that you talk about it, because we invariably assign a wrong meaning, and that can years later then become trauma, which means that we have a problem with aspects. So that's why they say it's so important to talk about things immediately after event with people who are there, so that you basically say in mind, oh, it was the meanings you assigned were wrong. You basically understand what's happened. You acknowledge the emotion. Okay, so that's it. So when you say PTSD, did I suffer post-traumatic stress? Probably. Now, post-traumatic stress, and this is, sorry if I'm sounding rather lecturing here, but you go, so let's say immediately after the Grenfell disaster, the burning tower, I cannot imagine what that must have been like. And if you suddenly got up and you look up to that burning pyre, knowing that the people you love are died in there, and everyone's saying, I've got PTSD. With respect, and to say this without being disrespectful or unfeeling for those people, no, you've got post-traumatic stress, probably, which means post a traumatic event, you are suffering extreme stress. And it's part of your coping mechanism as you start to come to terms. So you may be really in a heightened emotional state. You may be tearful. You can't sleep, cry, whatever. That's post-traumatic stress. Perfectly normal thing, okay? Some people do it rapidly. Some people do it, maybe weeks, couple of months. But it's a perfectly normal event. So from the information I got, about 75% of human beings suffer from a traumatic event, cope. So 75% of people cope with extreme experiences. And then you've got 23% or so suffer post-traumatic stress, which is an extended coping mechanism over a period of time, let's say a week, couple of months, where you can't function very well. Post-traumatic stress disorder is a psychological disorder where you become dysfunctional a time later. Now, that means in the military, normally it's about 14 years, and it is a psychological disorder. So when people say, I've suffered PTSD, no one's going to say it, but with the great respect, no, you're not. You're suffering as any human being probably would, given the extremities of your experiences to that. And from the things I got given when I got returned, only about 2% of people, and it may be slightly larger now, suffer post-traumatic stress disorder. Okay. If you talk to Helen, my wife, she would say, I am more confident since I came back. So actually, experience gave me confidence. And that's what I mean, because you've heard of post-traumatic growth, haven't you?
No.
Why not? There's two sides to post-trauma. You've got post-traumatic stress disorder and you've got post-traumatic growth. Why? It's not a story. It's like you saying you've got two stories of you on your holiday. God, I went to the airport. Oh, shit. You know, the taxi was late. We got, you know, stuck on the motorway. Then we got to the airport. Our flight was cancelled. You know, almost divorced my wife. The kids were a nightmare. They shat themselves in the airport right in front of everyone. We had no food, no drink, slept on the hotel floor, and we had to come home. What a great story. That is a pub story for life. That is great. Whereas if you go, hi, John, yeah, what do you do? Oh, I've just been on holiday to Spain. Yeah, it's perfect. We managed to, you know, have a wonderful time with the kids. And God, you know, our grandparents came with us. They looked after kids. So God and my wife wear the most fantastic lingerie, and we made love every day of the week, and we swam in Turquoise Lagoon. You've lost him, really? What a boring story. We don't want to know that. We want to know all the bad stuff. So it's not a story, sorry. But it's true. You know what I mean? You go, really? Your life is so good. Can you just shut the hell up? I want you to tell me something that equates to my life, because my life is misery. So post-traumatic growth is classic Nietzsche. That which doesn't kill you makes you stronger. Post-traumatic growth is that effectively our character is forged, not found. We grow from adversity. Shed skins, we grow from adversity. And that's what I found the God did for me. I am, so Helen says, I'm a bit more emotional, and that's fine by me. But also, as I get older, you get more sentimental as you get older. You think how sentimental you are now compared to when you were 20 and your testosterone is that high. Well, now why? It's called biology. Our testosterone moves down. It means men become more reasonable because we have less aggression. Mm. Yeah. We've lost our balls, basically. That's why you look at the 20-year-old and go, God, what an ignorant young man I was, and why did I not know that now when I was there? Well, because it's called biology. So, sorry if I sound rather logical and everything and not sentimental, but you end up going, there are reasons why these things happen. It's how you consider them in a detached manner. So you can tell here, this is a fighter pilot come up. It's don't immerse in the... in the emotion. I found in captivity I flip-flopped. Sometimes in captivity your mind will run away and your worst enemy is yourself, and you catastrophize. So sometimes you have to pull that back in and go into yourself or identity in your emotional self, go, no, I may be thinking that, but that's not real. Other times when you're during the beating and you're overwhelmed with fear, you have to detach yourself and use your rational self to go, it's not real. You just need to calm yourself. So I became pretty good at being able to control whether I'm emotionally running away myself or psychologically running away myself. Use whichever works at the time to remove that so that you keep yourself controlled. Mm. And actually, if you want to know what a fighter pilot is, the general psychologists say, fighter pilots are controlled type characters. They like to control things. And so I suppose I conformed to that. So Helen says, I'm no different. I'm just more confident. I hope I've covered the psychological PTSD. And we should, by the way, I will put this right on because it's important. I totally support therapy for those who have difficulty, and certainly I'll do it from a military perspective. You have young men and they're sent to war 18, 19, who go to war on our behalf and do things that would make a buffalo, you know, throw up and experience life, and they come back and they have problems years later because they've kept us in our nice middle class homes with, you know, our Volvo car outside, and yet they can't function in their life. We damn well should support those people and have a conversation for as long as it needs to get them back into their mental health back. And I believe in that. But not everyone needs therapy. So that's what they found after Falklands War. They found that by saying, "Are you okay? Steve, are you okay?" You go, "Well, I thought I was okay. Maybe I'm not okay." And you can actually send someone into a spiral. So they've just got a bit clever of how we deal with psychological, highly traumatizing events, and how we deal with it is understanding how human beings cope. And some people cope immediately, others over time. And therapy has its place, but it's not the answer. It's one answer. It's being able to weave that therapy, should it be required, into that person's ability to deal with it.
JP, we're up against the stop on time, but can I ask you one or two other follow-up questions?
Yes,
just
okay,
on the military side of things then. When you were going through your experience and explaining it to us, you talked about when you stepped to the jet, it must have been frustrating for the crew who got to the spares while theirs broke, and they got to the spare and the spare broke, and frustrating for them because they would have obviously been wanting to go out there and do their thing and prove that they could do it. You talked about your experience with John being excited about finally being able to say, well, I've done this 1,000 times in practice, now I'm going to do it for real, I'm going to prove who I am. You talked about coming off the target, about carrying the bomb still, and then saying, shall we re-attack? We don't want to go back to a crew room and say we failed. Mm-hmm. And you've mentioned the word failure a couple of times, but of course thankfully, you did get back home. You did go back to the RAF, you did go back to flying the Tornado again. I wondered having heard you very eloquently describe the psychology behind, you know, slotting in something into your mind, compartmentalizing things, having an attitude, having an approach, being in control, what was the reception like amongst your fellow aviators in the crew room? Were you accepted? Was there any guilt that you felt for not being successful in prosecuting that attack and for becoming a POW? What was it like going back into the Tornado crew room after captivity?
Most fighter pilots were great at school, great at sport, and they go through a highly selective system, and it's highly competitive. So you're talking about a whole bunch of self-motivated, autocratic, arguably, individuals who are competitive. What would you do if you've done 25 war missions and done really well, been shot at, everything like that, and you get back and over above everyone's pleased to be back and your family's pleased to see no one gives you any attention, and you've got two people called John Peters and John Nicol who get global attention and become famous? You take the piss, which is wonderful, because that's how it is. Everyone takes the mickey. Now, it's like doctors and nurses and operating theatres, military, the emergency service, it's black humour. But done in a way, and this is where you've got to be very careful sometimes with political correctness, with people's language, that's how human beings deal with each other in reality. And we all say the wrong things or what have you. But it's the intent behind those words. And there's a warmth behind their words. It's basically, you're one of us, you know. Right? And for all the public stuff of people taking the mickey, everyone comes up individually, because it doesn't remove humanity. Hey, mate, or just look at you. And this is classic. Sorry, you go, hey, Steve, wanker. But in that, the way they do it, you know what I mean? You know when you're a mate, or just, but he'll put his hand on you. He never does that, you know, hey, wanker. And you go, yeah, thanks. And he's basically saying, you know, you get into the American, you know, love your mate. What? We just don't do that. But the warmth and the inclusivity on that is lovely. Everyone came, you know, and said, I wanted my war, not yours. And we had one incident where, long story short, where the new space wanted to fill John and I in our first flight, and we said, no, don't do that. We didn't have a choice. So they had eventually 6 coach loads of journalists come, and they were crowded around John and I, and they didn't even look at a single one of our friends who had all been to war. You've got 50 of your mates all been to war, and we had lost a crew on our squadron. And They didn't even interview a single one of them, and you have, you know, 200 people just focused on us. Do you know how often you apologize to all your friends on that? And it wasn't our choice.
Mm.
We said no, but and probably the most emotional thing is they all understood. I found that actually more hurtful, or it hurt me more because they were so bloody understanding. A flight commander I had, who I didn't know that well, really, pulled me aside. And he's a very particular character, actually, this flight commander. And I thought quite an unemotional sort of bloke, really quite, you know, detached. And he called aside and he said, "John, Coffin had never done that to me." Okay. And he said, "By the way, we all wanted our war, not your war. Don't ever worry about stuff like this. We all understand. We get it." He said, "I didn't want your war. You've gone through something now." And that care I hold very dear. So you're pulled back into the stuff. So it's lovely, but done in a way that's not schmaltzy. It's done in a way that's not inappropriate. It's done, but it's done in a very British way, that, you know, that is making fun. And even the aircrew, when you, at air shows, you know, suddenly all these other aircrew just coming in. We're all the same. We all went to war. We all know what it's like. And they were just inclusive. So, no, I was very blessed. You see the best of it.
Final question then, JP. So just to round off where we started, really, when you joined me on the first interview, I asked you to introduce yourself, and you said, I think the first thing you said was, "I'm not a very good fighter pilot because I've got one more takeoff than landing." And then, of course, you went and recalled your experiences. Mm-hmm. But I just wonder whether or not, from a fighter pilot's point of view, there's kind of a hole there that was never filled for you in terms of being able to go out and do the job. There is this expression, certainly on the US side of things, where you say the fighter pilot's prayer, "Please God, don't let me fuck this up." And I wonder, you know, it's really interesting to hear you talk today about the fact that actually you don't believe it was switch pegs. You don't believe it was an error that by a John Nichol in your backseat, there's an alternative explanation that you're satisfied with. I don't think I've heard that before. But I wonder whether or not that leaves you then with your Air Force career behind you with an itch that wasn't scratched.
What do you mean by an itch that wasn't scratched?
Because you didn't get bombed. You didn't put the bombs on target. And you've talked a couple of times about failure. Your intro was, "Well, I'm not a great fighter pilot because." You know, do you feel like it would have been, you know, if there'd been a Gulf War II a couple of years later and you'd gone in, would you have been itching to go in there and prove that you could do it? Or would you have had the same sort of philosophy towards going and flying your first combat mission as you did the first combat mission, if that makes sense?
I think I would have gone back in. It is what phrase I use all the time. It is what it is. So was our mission a failure? Yes, it was. It was a wrong decision for a start. Nothing to do with me. Someone else made that decision. Our bombs didn't come off. Yeah. But they are trying to stop you as much as you're trying to bomb them. And there are two or three reasons, as I say, you can go as to why bombs didn't come off. I suppose because during flying training, I got chopped off buccaneers, which I think I covered in the first one. Yes, does it prove that they were right? I'm relatively sanguine about that as well. You say maybe they did me a favor. First of all, I didn't want to be on buccaneers. Secondly, now my sole reason on buccaneers was to get off buccaneers, which is not a way you start a program. It's not a way you start your flying career, is it really? But actually, however much I found it hurtful for my ego and everything, sometimes flying is just time in, and maybe they saved my life. You know, back in the day that you don't even know. There's a great book called Five or Seven People You Meet in Heaven. And these are people who, through dynamics of life, you don't even know, but they had a massive effect upon your life, and you don't know them. So maybe these people have made decisions to meet me in chop, which delayed everything, which made me into. Maybe they saved my life because I could have been a dead buccaneer pilot. So you'll find from this sequence that you say, it doesn't define or label you. It's an event that didn't work for you. So the golf was an event that did not work for me. But then that doesn't mean I'm necessarily a bad fighter. But one of the greatest things I had was when I became a tornado instructor at the end. And you get people who are defined as really good pilots and have great reports, and people who are defined as bad pilots. What I found really enlivening as I sat in the back with all these different fighter pilots, do you know, everyone pretty much average. Now, when you meet average fighter pilots, I mean, they're really, but you go pretty much the same. It depends whether the weather's good or bad, you know, but pretty much you rarely meet someone with real talent. That's really rare. It's godsend. It's brilliant. And you go, wow, but 1 in 100. And you probably meet 3 or 4 who could be better. Do I believe I'm in a 3 or 4? No, I think I'm a pretty average fighter pilot. And that's fine by me. I did my childhood dream. Was I going to be Maverick? No, I wasn't. I knew that from early on. But hell, how many people want to be a fighter pilot? I got shot down. Yeah, it happened. Yes. I've dealt with it. Yeah. I made this decision in captivity. Could I go back and do it again? Yes, I could. And my decision had nothing to do with me. It was more if we were in formation and my number two or my number one, whoever I'm, you know, in formation with, was getting attacked, would I come across and put my body on the line to save their life before my own? Yes. And I made that decision in captivity, and I would not have got back in a military jet had I not had that thought. So again, it's just an event. I've dealt with it. Could I go back and do it again? Yeah. I was on my way out for the second Gulf War. I would in it. Do I itch to go to war? No, I don't. Because you've got to be a fool if you want to go to war, you know. No, I'm generally overall pretty comfortable with it. I wish I, yes, like anybody who's competitive, I wish I was the best in the room. I wasn't. Am I in the worst in the room? No, I don't believe I was. I had just had a very public failure. But it's a failure event. It's not a defining failure. Defining means you label yourself throughout your entire life. No, I just had an experience. But no, so does that answer your question? I'm pretty comfortable where I am.
Yeah, it does. I was, you know, curious to know whether or not there was sort of was a hole there that you kind of felt was never filled, but it doesn't sound like that's the case. So that does answer the question.
But you see, you grow up as well. What I mean is, you know, when you're young and 20 and you'd give your arm or leg just to have a trip in a flight, fast jet, it's definitive. How I say to people, you join the Air Force, you know, so many people leave. So it's a dream job. It's a childhood dream. Who would leave a dream job? Well, lots of Air Force pilots you see in the papers are leaving. Why would you leave a dream job? And the reason is, has nothing to do probably with the Air Force, and has, well, Air Force, nothing to do with flying, because you wouldn't. Why you leave is you join as normally a single man or woman, and you then leave as a married person or in a relationship. So the challenge you have now is it used to be pilots joined at 18, 19, back in the day with, you know, older aircraft, they were flying by 21. You could get 10 years before they were in a big long-term relationship with children. Now with university, most people join, have a gap year, university, then there's a delay through flying training, la, la, la. They get on their frontline squadron when they're going to go away for lots of times and do all the real stuff. But they're 28, 29. Well, you know, by that age, people are coupling up, they're having babies, they're doing all sorts of things, and that doesn't fit their normal life. And they're getting posted around, and they want a mortgage, and therefore they need their spouse to work, because now, not like when I joined, where you had one person who had an income and you could afford a mortgage, you need two people. Therefore, they can't live a life of choice for their degrees and all the stuff they're good that the military can provide. So it's the dynamics of, oh, and by the way, the military won't get more money because it doesn't win votes, and the government doesn't have any money. So we've got someone you just spent £2 million training who, after 3 years, disappears. So you're not getting return on investment. We haven't got experienced fighter pilots. And therefore, the system goes, oh, Well, it's the dynamics of the world has changed. So how do you do that? So it's, yeah, you leave. I'm proud I was a fighter pilot, but my focus moved from myself to my family and my children, because that's what anybody who grows up does, isn't it? That's what we all do. And I think it's, for me as a man, seeing I'm, you know, must have some selfish, arrogant focus, like all people who push for a career. But once you get older, you kind of go, when you were younger, God, why did I do that decision? Well, you're pushing to achieve something. But as you get older, you realize that along that way, maybe you weren't as understanding with other people's needs. But as we get older, we realize, maybe hopefully it's a bit of life wisdom where you realize it's not just about you.
Did your children have any interest in going into the Air Force and following your footsteps?
No, my son went into the army. Very proud. My son went into the army, an army officer for 7 years. My proud bit. He won the Queen's Medal at Sandhurst. He was extremely sharp. He's been better at every single stage of his life than I was. And so he's a very talented young man. And my daughter, likewise, you know, she has done extremely well. So, you know, and now when you say this extension, I now am a grandfather. You know, I've got, my daughter's just had two grandchildren. So again, it's less and less about me, even though I am probably a self-centered man, partly maybe by character, secondly, by the level of attention you have. It's very difficult when you always have, you know, how many of my mates get an interview like this? Zero. Mm. You know, so you are constantly talking about your own life experiences, which is challenging to, in normal life, to not talk about them.
I think that's a good note to end on, JP. And I wanted to say thank you. One of the things that's been on my mind is that you must get asked to do these sorts of things a lot. And I'm really, really grateful that you said yes to me and you've given me two interviews. And I think some really interesting and quite different insight into some of the psychology behind being a fighter pilot and life in general. So thank you for sharing with us.
My pleasure. Good to talk to you.
Thanks for tuning in to 10% True. I hope you enjoyed this episode. Feel free to subscribe, and if you're on YouTube, hit the bell button to make sure you get notified of the next episode. Thanks and take care.